Hey, Bible nerds, this is Dr. Manny Arango, and I'm your host for the Bible Department podcast powered by Arma. This podcast follows a Bible reading plan we created to help you read the entire Bible in a year. You can head to the show notes or thebibledepartment.com to download our reading plan and join the journey.
Family, welcome to day 326. We are diving into a brand new book of the Bible. We are diving into Song of Songs. And today, we've got Song of Songs chapters 1, 2, and 3. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the freakiest book of the Bible. It's going to be fantastic. God invented sex. Yes, he did. It's God's idea. Sex is not the enemy's idea. Sex is not just what your flesh wants to do. And for so long in church, we have perpetuated this demonic idea of purity culture. And Song of Songs honestly debunks the entire idea that sex is dirty, filthy, bad, you know, that there should be any guilt associated with it. And so over the next 3 days, we're going to dive into this amazing, awesome, wonderful book of the Bible. And so if you haven't done the reading, if you haven't done Song of Songs, chapters 1, 2, and 3, then I want to challenge you to stop the video, pause the audio, go get the reading done. You go get the reading done and then come back and we're going to dive in. I'm going to give two big disclaimers before we jump into our context clues, our nerdy nuggets, and then obviously our timeless truth for the day. The first disclaimer is we have an entire Song of Songs course on the Arma platform where I really do walk through this book chapter by chapter, verse by verse, line upon line, like a really nerdy deep dive into Song of Songs. We have a purity culture course and a Song of Songs course on the Arma platform. Obviously, you got to be a subscriber in order to access that content. So maybe that's something that you want, or maybe you're like, you know what? I like the free 99 plan. I'll just stick with what you're doing on the Bible department. Either way, I'm glad that you are here. Just wanted to make you aware that if there's something that we don't cover here in the next 3 days, we got way more than 3 days worth of content on the library. And so you may want to check out the Arma library. All right. Second disclaimer is that Song of Songs and the way that the church has engaged with this one book of the Bible is actually indicative of a bigger issue that the church has, and that is a real disdain or dislike, or maybe even like a denial of humanity, like things that are just human. And so there's a lot of things that kind of typically or stereotypically or generally speaking can make like Christians or church people uncomfortable. And one of those is like the humanity of Jesus. We love talking about the divinity of Jesus. When we start talking about the humanity of Jesus, I think it makes people uncomfortable, right? That Jesus, you know, drank, ate, pooped, peed, like that Jesus got tired. He went to sleep. Like, I think, you know, Jesus' humanity makes us really uncomfortable. But also when we talk about the humanity of the Bible, we get uncomfortable. So anytime we say, yeah, this is the word of God, people will say amen. And then you're like, yeah, but it's also the word of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Moses. And people are like, nah, I don't know about that. And the same thing is true when we start talking about sex. People are uncomfortable with sex and sexuality really because we're uncomfortable with our own humanity. And there are two extremes, okay? And God is trying to help us to avoid both extremes. And I think that's a big reason why a book like Song of Songs is even in the Bible. Is the two extremes for the human is to either try to act like an animal or an angel. Okay, these are two extremes. The secular society that we live in can be very animalistic. So have sex with whoever you want, do whatever you want, no guardrails around sex or sexuality or sexual expression. Just kind of, you can be an animal. You know, you can indulge all your primal urges, you know, be an animal. And then in the sacred world, or maybe in the Christian world, or in the religious world, the emphasis is be an angel, be angelic. So act like your sensual, sexual, fleshly desires aren't even there. Suppress them, ignore them, you're an angel. And the reality is that humans are not animals, or angels, that these two extremes both have pitfalls. I would say equally damaging pitfalls. These extremes are both like really toxic, really dysfunctional, and very, very problematic. Whereas Song of Songs is a celebration of the sexual union and the thrill and the fun and the excitement of sex and the pleasure that comes along with sexual expression in the confines that God says is good for his people. And that's the context of marriage. And so, you know, for people who are married, there's no angelic behavior. We ain't angels, baby. We gonna act like humans, and we're gonna do what humans do. But we're also not animals. And extremes are easy, but truth is found when you hold things in tension. And I think that's what the book of Song of Songs is doing. I believe that's what it's designed to do. And if we believe that the devil invented sex, or that it's evil or inherently wrong, man, that creates so many problematic ideas. Not only did God invent sex, but that makes me like God way more. I can rock with a God who could invent something as awesome and pleasurable and fun and fantastic as sex. Man, that God, whatever God invented sex, I'm rocking with that God. I like that God, okay? That sounds like a fun God to me, all right? God could have made it so that humans procreate with no pleasure, but he didn't. He wanted the act of procreation to be pleasurable. God could have made it so that food or drinks like coffee didn't have a taste, but he created taste buds, okay? Because he's a God of pleasure, and there's nothing wrong with pleasure. And one of the things that you're going to notice throughout the book of Song of Songs is that it's not just about sexuality, but sensuality, that your senses should be engaged, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the ears, the feel, okay, that your senses should be engaged. And what one of the, you know, problems with purity culture, it's almost like if you make people feel like sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And you just turn all of someone's sexual, you know, urges off, and then it's almost like we have this unrealistic expectation that once people get married, it's just going to flip on, and now it's back. Whereas I know so many Christian couples where it's like, you know, they got sold this lie that if they ignore sex, don't think about it, you know, just it's bad, it's bad, it's bad. You know, they got sold this lie that God's going to bless you with the best sex life ever, that you're going to get married and it's going to be fantastic. And the reality is that I know a lot of those couples, I've counseled a lot of those couples, I've pastored a lot of those couples where they got married and it wasn't awesome. It wasn't fantastic. Actually, all that messaging of this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad has created an inability in both men and women for their bodies to even function the way that God designed them to function. I know young women who, because of religious ideas and because of purity culture, struggle with issues like vaginismus, which means that like your vagina literally just closes up and nothing's getting in, nothing's getting out. And they've had to gotten married, realize they nothing could happen and had to go get, you know, had to go seek a therapist and like get healing because the church's messaging is sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad. On the other end of the extreme, you know, that's the angelic, you know, you're an angel, you're an angel, you're an angel. You don't have desires. You don't have desires. Suppress, 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 ignore. Like that's damaging. That literally creates damaging effects. I know married people who are Christians who barely have sex. They're in a relationship that is sanctioned by God. God is like, go for it, have fun. And they still can't get over the guilt or the shame that they learned in church. Okay. The other extreme is I know people who, you know, prior to getting married, lived animalistic lives, just like no guardrails, no self-control. And, you know, it's like because of the effects of pornography, have now come into marriage. And again, being human, they've acted like animals for so long that now they don't know how to be human.
And if you act like an angel for too long, you won't know how to be human. And if you act like an animal for too long, you won't know how to be human. My goal over the next 3 days is just to quiet down all those animal urges and quiet down all that angelic purity culture crap and just kind of restore humanity. Humanity. You're human and you were designed for sex. You were designed to enjoy sex. You were designed, God made sex for you. Like he made it so that you could enjoy the union of becoming one with one person for one lifetime. That anything outside of that is outside of God's, you know, realm, desire for you. So, all right, only got a couple minutes left and I've talked a lot. So those disclaimers took up a lot of time. Let's actually get to a context clue and at least a couple of nerdy nuggets for the day without this episode getting too long. I hope that that's helpful. And let's talk about our big context clue for the day. So there are four main interpretive approaches for even looking at a book like Song of Songs. Now, the first one is probably the one that most of you are familiar with, okay? And it's the one that I'm going to debunk the most, okay? So there's four interpretive approaches. Before you even read the book, you kind of have to decide, how am I going to interpret this book, okay? So I'll give you the four if you're taking notes. There's an allegorical approach. And I would say that part of the reason that we allegorize a book like Song of Songs is because sex makes it uncomfortable. And I'm going to try to help us to fight the urge to allegorize this book. An allegorical approach is just going to make Yahweh the groom, Israel the bride, or Jesus the groom and the church the bride. And none of this is about sex. None of this is about sexuality or sensuality. And it's just all about, you know, Jesus and the church. There's a lot of people who preach that and teach that. I'm going to say that's nonsense. That's literally not founded in an academic or scholarly approach to reading the Bible. That's not exegetically honoring to the text. That is a total manipulation of the scriptures. Anyway, all right, number two, there's a cultic approach. This approach kind of views, or this view, okay, holds that these are originally Canaanite mythological erotic poems that would have been used in their first form in fertility cults. Okay. And then what happened is that the Jewish people got a hold of this stuff and cleaned it up and Yahwehfied it. Okay. This view points to the fact that there are similar poems that existed in the cults of Baal and Tammuz, which were used in sexual fertility rites as a part of worship. The idea is that these poems were taken by the Israelites, edited with the obvious Canaanite pagan elements removed to create a sanitized Israelite version to be used in wedding ceremonies. Okay, so that's that. Okay, I don't line up there, but legitimate approach. Okay, so allegorical approach, cultic approach. Third, you may be familiar with this one. We call this the dramatic approach. Okay, this attempts to create a plot within this collection of poems. So the separate erotic poems are in fact one story of the beloved and the bride. Okay, this is why in many translations, the text is separated into characters to give the impression that you're reading a screenplay. There are two versions of this drama, which either it's either that there are two main characters or what is effectively a love triangle. Okay, those are the two options for the dramatic approach. The first option is the story of the beloved, who could be Solomon, who falls in love with a simple country girl and brings her back home to the palace. The second is a love story between a shepherd and a country girl, who is then taken by Solomon to his harem. The girl ultimately rejects Solomon and returns to her shepherd lover. In both dramas, chapter 3, verse 6 to chapter 5, verse 1, is seen as the wedding and the first night of the honeymoon, and so is the central part of the story. This is a very popular way to view the book, especially in Protestant circles. But there's one issue with it, an issue that is also problematic in certain ways of viewing Job and Revelation. The issue is that there's no evidence that Israelite or the wider Semitic world had this form of drama or theater in their culture. Greeks, yes. Jews, not so much. So that leaves us with a fourth approach, and it's going to be the approach that honestly we're going to focus on the most. It's the one that has the most, you know, I would say credence in my mind is the lyrical approach. So we've talked about allegorical, cultic, dramatic, and now lyrical. Possibly the most common view held by scholars today. And one of the things that I want to emphasize all the time on this podcast is that there are things that are normal in school, like theology school or like Bible school or like seminary, normal views to have, but that are weird at church. And part of what we're doing or trying to do is like bridge the gap that exists between academia and the church. We need like a church that's smart. Like we need Christians who are intelligent, okay? I wish there was a more tactful way to say that, but it's just the reality. All right, the most common view held by scholars today is that this Song of Songs, what we have here in the Bible, is a collection of wedding songs, possibly written by different authors at different times, but then later brought together in this collection. It is not meant to be an allegory, is originally Hebrew, which means it's not cultic, and is not meant to be seen as a story. It does, however, show how Jewish wedding ceremonies often reflected on the original marriage in Eden. This is why the garden setting and the garden metaphor is used throughout the poems. Weddings are when man and woman come together as one flesh in a reflection of what happened in the garden with Adam and Eve. That is the garden ideal, where the man and the woman were naked together with no shame. How many poems there are is debatable, with some saying there are as little as 5 poems in Song of Songs, and some scholars saying there could be up to 34 individual poems right here in Song of Songs, just in 8 short chapters. So I think that the cultic approach has zero legitimacy. I think that the dramatic approach has small amounts of legitimacy. I actually do think that the allegorical approach has a small amount of legitimacy, but only in that Yahweh is seen throughout the Old Testament as a groom, and Israel is seen in the Old Testament as a bride. Now, here's what Judaism and Christianity, well, here's what Judaism 100% definitely tried to avoid. In the Greco-Roman world, it was normal for gods to have sex with humans. Think about like Hercules. Okay, Hercules is the combination of a god, Zeus, having sex with a human, which creates a demigod named Hercules. And there's tons of gods in the Greek pantheon, and that's how they came to exist, is because the gods are really humans with superpowers. And these gods have sex with women. In the ancient world, especially books like Luke, go out of their way to make it very clear there's no, like, Jesus is not a demigod. So, like, there's no world where Yahweh, like, had sex with Mary in any way, shape, or form. And so I would caution anyone who's trying to allegorize these poems and make them about Christ in the church, because I would actually say the New Testament particularly is doing the exact opposite. Like, the New Testament is trying to separate God the Father from erotic or sexual activity as much as possible. And to be honest, that's kind of gross. Like, if we're just talking about love, then yeah, like, yes, God loves his children and Jesus loves the church. But this Song of Songs isn't just about love. It's about erotic sexual love. And when we talk about erotic and sexual love, that is the kind of love that is relegated to the realm of marriage. We do not have an erotic or sexual type of love relationship with God. We don't. I'm sorry. Like, we don't. Does the Father love us? Yes. Like, does Jesus love us? Yes. But we should be avoiding all kinds of ideas that God is somehow involved with us sexually or erotically. How people don't see that natural pitfall when you allegorize a book like Song of Songs, I don't know. But hey, so what is Song of Songs actually designed to do? It's designed to help humans celebrate this amazing thing that God made called sex, and to put it back in its original context, which is the Garden of Eden. All right, I'm going to give a couple of nerdy nuggets and then we're going to close the episode because I'm already over time. Okay, I'm going to just outline where the poems actually start and finish. So the first poem is going to be from chapter 1, verse 2 to chapter 2, verse 7. Okay, that's poem number 1. Poem number 2 is chapter 2, verse 8 to chapter 2, verse 17. So that poem is pretty short. Okay, 9 verses. And then poem number 3 is even shorter. It's chapter 3, verse 1 to chapter 3, verse 5. And then poem number 4, which we'll really get into tomorrow, is chapter 3, verse 6 to chapter 5, verse 1. So it starts in today's reading, but it really ends in tomorrow's reading. So we'll talk about it tomorrow. Couple of things that I just want to highlight as we kind of move through this. First, the female character is the first to speak, which is really cool. Because one of the things that Song of Songs is trying to do is trying to get you back to the ideal, which is Adam and Eve as co-leaders in the garden. It's not till the fall that we have Adam, who's placed over Eve, and there's a lot going on there, and we don't have time to get into it. But what we have here is that the woman is initiating. The woman's the first voice that we hear, because it's not God's goal for men to subjugate women, but for women to be leaders in the relationship. Also, the woman's voice is contrasted to Eve's voice. Whereas Eve spoke and led Adam to sin, the woman here is going to speak, but she's going to continually be saying, hey, don't arouse love or awaken love until it's time. You can tell she's a little insecure about her darkness. So, you know, as being a black male, it's important for me to really exegete, like, what's going on here? Well, in this culture, paler skin was more desirable. It had nothing to do with race, but had everything to do with wealth and status. So if you were wealthy, you didn't have to work the vineyards. You could stay indoors, protected from the sun. But if you were outside, the issue wasn't the darkness of your skin. The issue was that the darkness of the skin proved that you were poor or that you were working class, okay? And so she's saying, oh, man, I'm dark. I'm still beautiful. She's still confident. But she's like, ah, I hope the fact that I come from a working class family isn't an issue for you, okay? And it's not. And he then compares her to a mare. Now, this is verse 9. Now, what's the analogy here? What's going on is that Pharaoh's chariot horses would have been pulled by stallions, male horses. And what he's saying is that imagine a mare in heat, a female horse in heat walks by, those stallions are going to go crazy. And what the man here is saying is like, you arouse me. Your dark skin ain't a problem for me, girl. You make me go crazy. Okay. It's hard for me to have self-control when I'm around you. I would say that's a good thing. That's a good thing. All right. I don't have time to go into the rest of these nerdy nuggets. I got a lot of them here. We'll pick up with nerdy nuggets tomorrow. But I will say this as our timeless truth. Two things in our timeless truth. We need to be leery of purity culture. I had a couple come to me and, you know, it was premarital counseling. They were engaged, ready to get married. And I was like, all right, like, is it hard? You know, like to keep your hands off each other? And they're like, no, Pastor, we're good. And I went, well, that's a red flag. I think I threw them off guard by being very like, well, that's weird. Like, if you're not so attracted to each other that it's not hard to keep your hands off each other, I don't know that I would get married. You should be struggling. Like, that's good. You shouldn't be falling into temptation, but you should actually be attracted to each other physically. And if you're not having a problem keeping your hands off each other, there may not be enough attraction there for you guys to actually be in a long-term relationship. That's just timelessly true. If you're a man and you're dating a woman and you guys are Christians, you should feel like you're a stallion and she's a mare in heat. You should feel like, God dang, man, I gotta figure something out here, okay? If you're just kind of like, yeah, we're fine. Psh, I'm not tempted. That's a red flag. You may want to break up. You may not like that girl. You know, she may know how to pray and do all types of things, but you just may not be attracted to her. And it's okay to admit that. Our second timeless truth is that timing is everything. We're going to get a repeated phrase throughout the book, but definitely throughout today's reading, which is this: daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field. Well, gazelles and does wait till they're in heat. They have a time to mate. They don't just mate constantly all year long. Okay, so by, I charge you by the gazelles and the does of the field. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. So timing is everything. And so if you're 20, I don't know, 2, 23, and you're broke, well, then you have no choice but to control your sexual urges because you need to put love to sleep. You don't need to awaken anything. And so timing is everything. Timing is everything. And you don't want to make a decision about marriage just because you lack self-control. Timing. And part of what the wisdom literature is doing is helping us with timing. That's what books like Ecclesiastes are going to do. It's like, hey, there's a time under the sun for everything. That's what Song of Songs is going to emphasize. Hey, there's time for love. There's a time for sex. There's a time for marriage. And you shouldn't rush into this just because you're horny. Like, that would be foolish. And that's not just true for the daughters of Jerusalem in the context of Song of Songs. That's true for you. That's true for me. That's timelessly true. All right, tomorrow we got day 327. We're going to continue our trek through Song of Songs. We're going to be looking at chapters 4, 5, and 6. Same time, same place. I hope to see you right here as we continue looking at the freakiest book of the Bible. It's going to be fantastic. I love you guys so much. Hey, if you're on a streak, I'm proud of you. If you are not on the streak, I still love you, and I'll see you right here tomorrow. Peace! Thank you so much for joining me on the Bible Department Podcast. If this episode was helpful, it would mean the world to me if you'd give us a follow, rate and review the show, and don't forget to share. You can learn more about the show at thebibledepartment.com and find us on Instagram at thebibledepartment. If you want to dive deeper into the Bible, you can get free access to our library of courses at thebibledepartment.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow. What if I told you that what you're learning in this video was just the tip of the iceberg? The Bible Department is actually powered by Arma. What is Arma? I'm so glad you asked. Arma is an online subscription-based platform that we designed to help people, everyday people, learn the Bible for themselves. We started Arma so that anybody, anywhere, could have access to trustworthy and entertaining Bible and theology content. In addition to this podcast, we have over 60 courses on individual books of the Bible, on theology topics, and on some hot topics like homosexuality, tithing, and women in ministry. But really, Arma is a community of people that I've gotten to know. A community where thousands of people are currently finding family, asking questions, and nerding out on the Bible together. If you want a community to read the Bible with you this year, or if you want to dive into some deeper theological content, or if you want more exclusive access to me and the entire Arma team, how about you go to thebibledepartment.com. I'll be sure to post the link in the description of this video. Let's make this your year to become a Bible nerd.